We are talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of the past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And by wrap-up of the past week's news, I mean we're going to try and squeeze some of that in this week, but the primary focus this week is actually talking about the coming election.
It is literally the primary focus, yes.
Let's dive in. This is something you've done regularly for decades now here on Eat the Airwaves.
A couple of decades.
And we've never, ever been wrong.
Okay, our legal department is waving at me all of a sudden. So
is that your cat?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's when that tail starts doing that weird kind of swishy movement, you know you're about to pureed.
In deep trouble. Okay, yeah, so let's get to the primary election, the candidates, and the ballot measure.
Very good.
Okay, should we start with the ballot measure?
Sure, that'll be quick.
Yeah, okay. King County Proposition 1 is to renew the regular property tax levy for children, youth, families, and communities. This would double the expiring county property tax levy to 19 cents per 1,000 assessed property value, so about $114 per year for a property assessed at $600,000, and a little over 10 bucks per month for a renter of a property of a similar value. It's a six-year levy with consumer price index increases built into it of up to 3% per year. The money would continue to fund things like food programs, developmental screening for children, health care and mental health care for youth, academic support, rental assistance to keep families housed, and programs to deal with substance abuse, domestic violence, homelessness, chronic diseases, etc., in families that would negatively impact the children in those families. It would fund child care subsidies, and it would also fund technical assistance for child care providers and social service providers who contract with the county to provide services under the levy. And I have to just point out some of the best anti-poverty programs. It's well proven and has long been known that some of the best anti-poverty programs are those that focus on health care and well-being of families and that focus on education and mental health care and other supports for children and young adults.
And that is why the federal child tax credit payments started this week are so important also.
Yes. So the progressive route to take on this proposition is to vote yes on Proposition 1.
Particularly in the wake of the impact of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I mean, now more than ever, really.
Yeah, now more than ever, kids who have been stuck at home, particularly kids and families that have issues like a parent who abuses drugs or is an alcoholic or who are struggling financially out of work and can't make all of their bill payments and pay rent. It's really super important to help those kids and those families get back on their feet and those kids get up to speed to recover from their lost year.
And the stats for domestic abuse have gone way up during the pandemic. Yeah. It should be noted too.
Mm-hmm. As well as things, other statistics that would point to problem issues like deaths from drug overdoses, for example, have skyrocketed over the past pandemic year. I'm sure things that are harder to measure, like alcohol use, have gone up as well.
And I can measure alcohol use.
And those things all have severe impacts on kids and families in particular. So this money is pretty desperately needed right now. So the progressive take on this is to vote yes on Prop 1.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
So looking at the candidates, King County Executive, did you want to take that one, Jav?
Sure. Dow Constantine is running for a fourth term. He's done a reasonably good job as county executive, and a lot of people like him. He's got, I believe, four challengers this year. The main one is Joe Wynn, who is a state senator from West Seattle, who has served one term on Olympia, is well-liked, very progressive. It's kind of surprising that he's running for county executive. My suspicion is that he's sort of doing it as a practice run to build his name familiarity and his campaign apparatus to run for something else in the future. He would be a solid upgrade on Dow Constantine. He is likely to make the general election. He is not likely to win. No pun intended, but, I like Joe a lot, and I don't have anything particular against Dow. There are things I could quibble with him against. He was very slow to agree to, no new youth jail. That took like months and months more negotiation than it probably should have.
Yeah, but, and he's taken kind of a gradual approach to phase out youth detention altogether in the county, whereas I think someone like Joe Wynn may have worked harder to do it sooner, and that may tip him over the edge in terms of getting into the primary and posing a serious challenge to Dow Constantine. They're both good candidates. Wynn is very progressive. He's also more in his identity. The fact that he's a person of color means that he's starting – it looks like he represents more of the folks who are starting to become the majority in unincorporated King County. Or maybe King County at large.
And we will talk about the county council in a minute, mm-hmm. but that is likely to become dramatically more progressive in the coming years. So that is something that argues for a less incrementalist county executive to work with them.
I think you're safe to vote for either one of those two if you're looking for a progressive person in office. If you want things to move a little faster and you'd like to see someone who in their person represents a growing minority that may soon become the majority in King County, then Joe Wynn would be your choice.
Yep.
So King County Council, as Job said, there are three districts that are up for up where the incumbents are up for re-election, all white people, all conservatives, longtime conservative incumbents, Kathy Lambert, Pete Von Reichbauer, and Reagan Dunn.
And their the voters about a decade ago voted to make the King County Council positions nonpartisan. Now, this was because the
But council these are all Republicans in these, their
yeah. The council was this was because the council was becoming increasingly partisan, and the three remaining people who were Republicans on that council are the ones who are now all up for re-election this year.
Yeah, and they represent, and I'll just describe the three districts geographically. District 3 is the northeast part of the county, which largely rural, or has been largely rural in the past, but is rapidly turning more urban or suburban.
Yeah. Geographically, it's the largest district in King County. It goes all the way to the crest of the Cascades. But the vast majority of the population is in places like Duval, North Bend, Issaquah. Out that way.
Why it's historically been so conservative. Now, King County Council District 9 stretches from southeast of Lake Washington to the south and east borders of the county. That's the second largest district geographically. Also covers a lot of the rural area south of District 3. But it also includes Renton, Renton is becoming more BIPOC. So, and is becoming a larger percentage of the district in terms of a population. And then the third district, District 7, is in the southwest corner of the county, including Federal Way and Auburn. That's Pete Von Reichbauer's district. And that district is rapidly turning more BIPOC as well, as people are pushed and priced out of Seattle and having to move to the South County in order to be able to afford rents and to afford just buying food, which is more expensive, and other things, gas and everything, which is all more expensive in the city of Seattle. So those three districts.
So would you like to start with Kathy Lambert?
Yeah, Kathy Lambert's district 3 in the northeast corner of the county, she's a 20-year incumbent, a conservative.
How she has survived all the various scandals that she has endured in her office. Basically, she has never had a strong challenger before, and she's got one this year.
The first time. Yeah, she's a conservative, not of the wacky right, but a very pro-business Republican. She does sometimes vote on Democratic proposals by other members. She's very good at kind of flipping back and forth that way, and that could be the reason why she has survived so long. As I said, her district is becoming more urban and suburban and is starting to swing more to the left. She's running against two other candidates, one of whom is Joe Cohen. He's a former staffer for Maria Cantwell, but is very similar to Lambert ideologically and would be sort of close to business as usual for this district. The better candidate is Sarah Perry, who has experience working in the nonprofit field as the nonprofit incubator Social Ventures Partners and on affordable housing at Eastside Housing, as well as on youth programs. She supports reforming the King County Sheriff's Office and standing up social workers and mental health care workers to respond to emergencies whenever they can instead of sending a guy with a gun and a badge. She also wants to expand transit options, build more affordable housing, and focus on helping small businesses and workers recover from the pandemic lockdowns. So Sarah Perry is the progressive choice for District 3. So King County Council District 7, that's the one in the southwest corner of the county, including Federal Way and Auburn. That's Pete Von Reichbauer's district. He's been incumbent in that district for 28 years.
Yeah, elected in 1993.
Nearly a generation. He also aligns with the Republicans, of course.
Needless to say, the district has changed a little bit during that 28 years.
Yeah, and he's the one who's most vulnerable in this election. He's drawn three challengers. But the best of the bunch, the outstanding person in the bunch, is Federal Way City Council member Lydia Asifa Dawson. She's a woman of color, an immigrant, a single mom, and a person who has managed a disability. Her focus is on providing job training, educational opportunities, a living wage for workers, apprenticeship programs, help for small businesses, and she would prioritize racial equity work, funding human service programs, and affordable housing, and would work to reform the King County Sheriff's Office. So Lydia Asifa Dawson is...
I like her a lot. She's very good.
Yeah, she seems really good. She has prior governance experience on the Federal Way City Council, so she would be a really good choice to bump her up to the King County Council. Now, King County Council District 9, that stretches from southeast of Lake Washington to the south and east borders of the county. Again, the second largest district geographically. It includes Renton, Maple Valley, and Enumclaw in the rural areas east and south of there, all the way to the Cascade Crest. This is part of the county, again, that has long been very conservative, but is tilting more progressive with an influx of BIPOC folks in the Renton area and an influx of immigrants. Now, the incumbent is Republican Reagan Dunn, who's held that seat for 16 years. And
he is the daughter of Jennifer Dunn, who's a former GOP congressman. She named him, of course, after her hero.
He's
got all the arrogance and entitlement that you would expect of somebody with that upbringing, honestly.
Who knows he's a member of a political dynasty, in essence.
And he has taken a hard turn to the Trump cult right in the last 5 years.
Yeah, and he's currently running on a platform of demonizing homeless people. Okay, so he needs to be rooted. The two very, very good candidates are running against him, both women of color, and a third candidate, a white male candidate who could also take this spot and be much better than Reagan Dunn.
That's a low bar, by the way.
I really like the two women of color. Ubax Gardier is a very effective community activist who successfully worked to help pass the nation's first $15 an hour minimum wage in SeaTac. Mm-hmm. And then she also worked with the folks who were implementing and passing that in Seattle. Her focus is on solutions to the affordable housing crisis while ensuring that her district continues to have green open spaces, which is very important for a rural district like hers. She would also be an effective candidate for structural change in the sheriff's department. And I think equally effective, if perhaps a little less radical, would be Renton City Council member Kim Con Van. One of only two Renton City Council members who voted to keep the Red Lion Hotel shelter open for homeless people in Renton. She wants to move up to the county council to tackle homelessness, affordable housing, and police accountability issues at the higher county level, where she feels she can be more effective than she's currently able to be in the progressive minority on the Renton City Council. Both of these are good. I think Gardier would be a slightly more progressive choice and a better choice to vote for King County Council. And it would not be bad for Kim Con Van to stay on the Renton City Council, where you would hope that local citizens would push to elect more progressive folks to support her and her other progressive council member.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Job, I think you liked the third candidate in that race.
Yeah, Chris Franco would be the first Latinx member of 16th County Council, which I think is a long overdue. And I think he's as progressive as the other two. So that's who I'm leaning to. But,
one of those three is better than Reagan Dunn.
Yeah, it's hard to go wrong voting for somebody other than Reagan Dunn.
Yeah. So we'll see. Let's hope that the vote isn't split between those three candidates. Well, you know, at least one of them will make it through the primary, so there will be a good challenger in the final if Dunn gets the majority.
Yeah, and I believe Franco has been leading in fundraising so far.
Yeah.
So he looks like a strong candidate.
Yeah. Okay, so for Seattle mayor, we've been...
I just wanted to make the point circling around. You can see why it would be helpful to have a more progressive King County executive to work with.
With a more progressive county council. That's very true. And that's some of the things we're going to talk that we're going to talk about a little bit, too, with the Seattle mayoral race.
Because yes,
Seattle, we do have a more progressive city council, and we have a mayor who is not. And that's, I think, the main reason why Lorena Gonzalez jumped into the mayoral race, is because she thought the city council really needed somebody in the executive position that the council could work with better. But in the Seattle mayor's race, we've been talking about the issues over the past few weeks. So if you want to go back and listen to the last three or four weeks shows, you can hear me give you a rundown on the different candidates' positions on things like homelessness and housing, police accountability, transportation. And that may help you decide if you're really torn about who to vote for. But essentially, to kind of summarize, the race has come down to three progressive candidates, who are Andrew Grant Houston, Lorena Gonzalez, and Jessen Farrell, versus three very problematic candidates: the old-style pro-business Democrat Bruce Harrell, who would like to take the council back to the Norm Rice era when the city council was a rubber stamp for whoever was in the mayoral office, and particularly responsive to the Downtown Business Association, but not to anybody else. The pretty flaky Colleen Echohawk, whose positions are strange sometimes. Sometimes they seem progressive, her solutions are very flaky.
I would say also very flexible, depending on who she's talking to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm not impressed with Colleen Echohawk. And Casey Sixkiller, who is currently Mayor Jenny Durkin's deputy, one of her deputy mayors, and has pretty much been running on Mayor Durkin's record.
Yeah, and Sixkiller's portfolio under Durkin was dealing with homelessness. And so he was directly responsible for implementing Durkin's "I'm going to characterize your policies toward homelessness as murderous," because they hurt more than helped, put it that way. And we have had record deaths for 4 years in a row of homeless people living on the streets.
As well, you know, yeah. And the Durkin administration has resumed doing sweeps during the pandemic in spite of a CDC advisory not to do that. They've resisted applying for FEMA money that was available for all cities in the United States to use to help house homeless populations in non-congregate shelters. And then both Durkin and Six Killer denied that there was that money available and that they didn't apply for it, which, local media has pretty much proven is true. That money was available and they didn't apply for it. So I'm not impressed with Six Killer. He would be business as usual, which has been, as Job said, murderous and really bad. Now, of the three progressive candidates, in my opinion, the outstanding choice is Lorena Gonzalez. Andrew Grant Houston has some great progressive ideas. He's a great idea man. I would love to see him gain more political experience, maybe as deputy mayor to Lorena Gonzalez, or as an advisor.
Houston is only 32 years old. I think he's got a great future. He has run a really solid campaign as a grassroots campaign. He has developed an army of volunteers. He is second in fundraising, only to Colleen Echohawk. And unlike every other candidate in the race, almost all of his donations have been small donations from, ordinary people. He has not been courting big business in a way that, say, Colleen Echohawk has or Bruce Harrell has.
He is the most progressive of the candidates. His motto has become structural change. And he has great ideas.
He is the only candidate who wants to fully defund SPD by 50%. He has talked a lot about the need to develop affordable housing in the wake of the pandemic and has talked about economic recovery for the pandemic from the standpoint of people who have lost work, small businesses who have been unable to survive, et cetera.
He supports rezoning all of the city of Seattle to remove single family housing in order to allow more affordable housing to be built. He has a lot of really good structural change ideas. He lacks the experience of running a large organization and of working in city government other than as a policy advisor. So I think it would be good for him to get some of that under his belt before we elect him to the highest executive office in the city.
Yeah, it takes a certain amount of executive experience to be able to manage 11,000 employees at the city of Seattle. That is a concern with Houston. I really think it comes down to whether you want to vote ideologically or pragmatically. And if your heart is on an ideological choice, then Houston is your person as a progressive voter.
Now,
if you want to get stuff done, let's talk about Lorena Gonzalez.
Yeah. Now, folks who are supporters of Jessen Farrell has plenty of political experience. But when I think about her, it really, in my mind, comes down to questioning her judgment in jumping into a race so late to challenge two very good progressive candidates of color, Andrew Grant Houston, who is Latinx and gay. And Lorena Gonzalez, who is Latinx and the daughter of farm workers. Gonzalez has done well as the president of the city council during what I think is possibly the toughest year in the city's history with the COVID-19 pandemic. She's kept the council working together and focused on some really important stuff like funding vital programs to help workers, immigrants, and small businesses that couldn't qualify for federal or state aid. I've been a skeptic about Gonzalez in the past. I've been mistrustful of her ambition, but I think her performance this year really won me over. She's a hard worker, and her priorities are right for the city, and she's stayed with the progressive wing on the city council. She's not waffled back and forth like I thought she would do. And she's been able to work well with the other members of the city council. And I think that's super important right now.
She came on the council as a protege of Ed Murray. And I think that fueled a lot of my distrust, honestly. Mm-hmm. But I have been won over also. She's done a solid job as council president, certainly compared to her predecessor, Bruce Harrell, who was deeply anti-democratic, did the minimum necessary work on council.
To have issues with remembering what he actually did and what actually happened on the city council when he was president. So and knowledgeable he was even at the time he was council president.
Yeah, he's been terrible on the campaign trail on being specific on issues. One of the things is about the three progressive candidates that we're talking about, they've also have by far the most specific policy platforms. Of the candidates. They have clearly thought through very carefully.
Consistently progressive policy platforms.
Yeah, they've clearly thought through very carefully what's possible and what they would like to do as executives. So that recommends all three of them. I think Gonzalez has been very good at being able to count to five on council in terms of, you know, developing the kind of coalitions that can get policies passed, that can get budgets passed. That recommends her as an executive also. She is a consensus builder, and God knows that would be an upgrade over the current mayor.
Yeah, and I'm concerned that if Houston were mayor, that things would that he would not be able to get people to work with him. And I think that might not be his fault, but maybe the fault of people who perceive him as too radical and they wouldn't work with him. Whereas Gonzalez, there may be some resistance to her because of her history on the city council and just because there's been a lot of particularly right-wing or mainstream Democratic conservative media attention on how bad, quote unquote, the city council is. But I think she would still be able to work with people.
Yeah.
So I really think the best choice.
The two biggest pressure groups that are of concern right now are Amazon and the downtown business community, number one, and number two, SPOC, the police union that has to negotiate a new contract. And the new mayor will be directly responsible for that, as well as picking.
Gonzalez is the current co-chair of the Public Safety Committee and was the prior chair of the Public Safety Committee on the City Council. So she is well positioned to be knowledgeable about and be able to negotiate the new SPOC contract.
Yeah, and the new mayor as well will need to pick a new police chief. And that's going to be a huge process.
Yes, and I think I would trust Gonzalez to do that better than just about any other candidate in the race. Now, Seattle City Attorney, okay, this is kind of a fun race this year because on one side you have the conservative.
You have certainly got a clear choice, clear choices.
You do have clear choices. On the one side, you have the conservative Seattle Times supporting perennial candidate Ann Davison, who is a Republican. And on the other side, you have the stranger, supporting Nicole Thomas Kennedy, who's running on a platform of abolishing the city attorney's role in prosecuting criminal misdemeanor cases in Seattle Municipal Court. Okay, so the stranger backing the far left and super progressive candidate, and the Seattle Times backing the far right Republican candidate. And in the middle, or quite a bit to the left of the middle, is longtime incumbent Pete Holmes, who's been in the office for over 10 years. And in every election, has fought off a business-backed challenger of one kind or another.
Yeah, Holmes originally came in. He upset Tom Carr, who in turn replaced Mark Sidran, both of whom were socially conservative, anti-homeless, and Holmes ran against that. He was the reform candidate. He's been very good on homelessness issues. He's been very good on cannabis issues. He's been very good on police reform. He originally, before he was city attorney, served on the OPA staff. So, you know, that's his background. And he's been solid as city attorney, but he is definitely facing interesting challenges this year.
Yeah. So challenges from the right, so that those two groups that Jav mentioned earlier, the Amazon / Downtown Business Association and the Seattle Police Officers Guild, or the culture at the Seattle Police Department, I'm sure would love to see Ann Davis and Sattler become city attorney and align their policies.
Yeah, Davison, who has dropped the Sattler for some reason, maybe she was too concerned that she's associated with Wingnuts now. But
which
she ran 2 years ago as a NIMBY candidate, in the 5th District, Northeast Seattle.
And
inexplicably got the Times endorsement that year as well. And then last year she ran and she ran as an independent. Last year she ran as a Republican for the nomination for Lieutenant Governor, lost in the primary, and again. And, that she's back to, claiming that she's an independent this year.
Yeah. So, to run for city attorney. And then on the other side, you have Nicole Thomas Kennedy, who is vowing to push for deeper reforms in, the Seattle Police Department, but particularly in the city's court system in terms of not punishing people for crimes of poverty, for misdemeanor crimes of poverty, which she says in her work as a public defender, she's still seeing far too many people in the city of Seattle being taken to court and prosecuted for minor misdemeanor crimes.
Yeah.
Now
she wants to decriminalize sex work. She has a bunch of progressive policies.
Very far left policies. So that makes this a very, very interesting race. Now, for somebody like me who has always voted for Pete Holmes, all I can do is think back on the reasons why I voted for him to deprioritize marijuana convictions before recreational marijuana was legalized in Washington state, establishing diversion programs that later have become a model for other cities across the United States. And his office has been defending some of the city council's most progressive laws in court, including the current jumpstart payroll tax. And he has a lot of experience doing that. And his office continues to provide some really important advice to the city council to help them shape current progressive legislation. They need to have folks at the city attorney's office review their bills for legality reasons. And his office is continuing to provide some very important feedback on those issues. And so I feel that the person to vote for in this race, if you really want to look ahead to what the city council and a new mayor, hopefully a new progressive mayor, will be doing in the coming years, would be Pete Holmes.
I don't know how I'm going to vote in November, but in the primary, I'd like to see Davison knocked out, which argues for a vote for Thomas Kennedy, because of course Pete Holmes is going to make it to the general. And I would love to, Thomas Kennedy describes herself as an abolitionist. I would love to see her debating Holmes on those issues, because I think Holmes would do better than a lot of people expect. Mm-hmm. But so I'm leaning toward Thomas Kennedy in the primary. The primary is the race where you can get away with voting for ideologues if you just want to see them make it to the general election, and that's where I am in this race.
Okay. And then let's talk about the two Seattle City Council positions, position 8, which is where incumbent Teresa Mosqueda is running for re-election against 10 minor candidates. Mosqueda took the lead on crafting the jumpstart payroll tax to fund affordable housing and homelessness services after the employee head tax fiasco. As chair of the budget committee, she has worked hard to open up the budget process to make it more transparent and allow more input by the city's citizens, and she's championed the participatory budgeting process along with Tammy Morales. And Mosqueda has a long history of supporting pro-labor legislation on the city council and helping to craft those. I think, of course, Mosqueda is the best choice for this position, and I don't see anybody else among her challengers that is worth considering.
You don't want to vote for Kate Martin or
no.
Alex Zimmerman?
No. No. So I don't think there's really anybody else to vote for in that position.
Now, that's a non-race, honestly. Moscada is head and shoulders above everybody else.
But Seattle City Council position 9, this is the seat left open by Lorena Gonzalez so she could run for mayor. There are 7 candidates, but only 3 of them are really running serious campaigns. Progressive Nikita Oliver.
And I think there is a lot of similarity between this race and the three-way race for city attorney, honestly.
Yeah, there's progressives Nikita Oliver and Brianna Thomas and conservative pro-business Democrat Sarah Nelson are running in council position 9. I don't think it resembles the city attorney's race very much. There is some similarity. I want to point out that Sarah Nelson is a former staffer for Richard Conlon. Kind of conservative Democrat.
I can speak to Conlon, and one of the main reasons he lost to Shama Sawant in 2013 when nobody expected it was Sawant got a lot of help from people who had tried to reach out to, people you wouldn't expect who tried to reach out to Conlon's office about one or another issue and were slimed because Conlon's office was terrible about constituents. That was the aspect of Conlon's office that Sarah Nelson ran. Yeah. So that's her experience, honestly. It does not argue for her.
Yeah, and Nelson in some of the virtual candidate forums that I've watched her perform in, she really struggles to keep up with the other two candidates on the issues. She's not up to date on issues that the city council is working on, and she really comes across as this being sort of a dilettante-ish run by her. Of the two progressives, Oliver is the powerhouse activist focused on racial equity and police reform, but they would also support other progressive issues like affordable housing, progressive tax revenue, and expanding labor protections to gig workers. Those are all issues that the council is likely to be working on in the coming year or two. Brianna Thomas is the council insider, Lorena Gonzalez's chief of staff, and so she has a lot of experience and knowledge of how the council works and of these same issues that the council has been working on. But so I think it comes down to whether you want to vote for somebody with a lot of experience like Thomas, or if you want somebody who has gained some experience running a large organization and representing clients who have had to go up against the Seattle Police Department. I feel that Oliver would get up to speed pretty quickly on the city council and that they would fit very well in a coalition with Tammy Morales, Teresa Mosqueda, Shama Sawant, Lisa Herbold, and Andrew Lewis. While they weren't quite ready yet to be mayor in 2017 when Oliver ran to be mayor of Seattle, I think Oliver is definitely ready now for a position on the city council. So I believe that you're safe to choose Nikita Oliver for council position 9. Brianna Thomas, however, would also be a very good choice for council position 9. And someone with a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience.
The way I look at it is my primary concern is keeping Sarah Nelson out of the general election. And I think Oliver is a shoe-in for the November election. I don't know that Thomas is. I'd like to vote for her. And I'm leaning to voting for her in the primary.
Strategic vote.
Yeah, as a strategic vote, I will almost certainly support Nikita in the general. I think she's been much more solid than she was as a mayoral candidate. And as one out of 9, I think they would be a much more constructive role than as the primary executive in the city. So I'm happy to support them in November, but for right now, I want to vote for Thomas to get her into the general against Oliver. I think seeing the two of them debating would be great.
And I think my feeling, though, is that Brianna Thomas could very easily become a deputy mayor or a close advisor to Lorena Gonzalez if she were elected mayor. So I would be very comfortable with Oliver on the city council and Thomas in that kind of a position, since Thomas has been serving as Gonzalez's chief of staff. So that's kind of my view on it, too. So
yeah. Well, you can choice. Yeah, you can see it each way. Thomas would be obviously a close ally of Gonzalez if she were to be on city council.
Also on the city council, yeah. Okay, so Seattle School Board, there are two director positions open. One in District 4, which is Queen Anne, Magnolia, and Ballard. This was Eden Mack's district, but Eden Mack resigned early this year, saying that it's a really thankless and impossible job to run such a large district with an all-volunteer part-time board.
And I was hearing the same complaint about by school board members in the 90s. So this is a structural problem that is long past due to be fixed. School board members need to be full time and they need to be have decent staffs
and some kind of pay for their work.
Yeah, the last I looked, it was something like $6,000 a year, which is ridiculous.
Is almost nothing. Yeah. Now, when Mac resigned, she was replaced by Aaron Dury, who is now running for election. But I feel that the better choice for Seattle School Board in this district is Vivian Song Meritz, who has both financial and management experience that is desperately needed right now on the Seattle School Board. Meritz also has a list of progressive changes she'd like to make, from ensuring racial equity to providing mental health services for children coming back to school after their lost pandemic year. And I just think Meritz really rises above the other candidates in the race for District 4. For Seattle School Board Director District 5, that's the downtown Capitol Hill and Central District, the obvious choice for this position is Michelle Sargu, who's a longtime resident of the CD, who has a background as a social worker. Her focus is on racial equity and providing enough resources for immigrant kids to excel, but she would also be a strong advocate for mental health programs and getting kids caught up after their lost year. Her main opponent, weirdly, is a white guy named Dan Harder. his name just makes me laugh, who is running on an anti-critical race theory platform. So, yeah.
Oh, you've got to be kidding.
No, I kid you not. So,
because there's so many elementary school students in Seattle who are brainwashed with critical race theory. Say
yeah,
what?
Exactly. Yeah.
What?
So,
really?
So Sargu for District 5 is probably the only competent candidate in that race,
good. The whole conservative, bugaboo of critical race theory misses the point that it's really only taught in law schools. You know, it is not taught in K through 12, period. End of story.
Yeah. So that wraps up our primary elections coverage.
Yeah, and I have my election recommendations in Facebook for people who want to go and take a look. And, of course, as Maria mentioned, you can go back to listen to archives of the past 3 weeks to hear summaries of candidates' various positions, mayoral candidates' various positions on issues. So I highly recommend those as well.
All right. Well, little bit of time left. Let's move on to the city council this week, at least one of the committees.
This week the city council committee passed the revised less lethal weapons ban. During the George Floyd protests last summer, the city council passed a ban on less lethal weapons for crowd control. Those weapons include tear gas, pepper spray, blast balls, flashbang grenades, rubber bullets, etc. Because the city is still under the police accountability agreement with the Department of Justice and under court oversight, that ban was put on hold by Judge James Robart because the council hadn't submitted it through the proper channels for evaluation and approval by the DOJ, the court-appointed monitor, and the judge. Council member Lisa Herbold has been shepherding a revised bill through her public safety committee, which passed unanimously out of committee this week with all five members voting for it. Those members were Lisa Herbold, Lorena Gonzalez, Andrew Lewis, Tammy Morales, and Shama Sawant. So what's in the revised bill? It states right in the first paragraph, quote, "No city department shall own, purchase, rent, store, or use less lethal weapons," end quote. But it provides a number of exceptions and exemptions. to comply with changes suggested by the three police oversight bodies, the Office of Police Accountability, the Office of the Inspector General of the Seattle Police Department, and the Community Police Commission, and changes suggested by the Court Monitor, the Department of Justice, and Judge Robart. Those exceptions include flashbang grenades can be used by SWAT teams outside of the setting of a demonstration to prevent serious bodily injury or death. 40-millimeter launchers to deploy chemical irritants like tear gas and pepper spray can be used by SWAT teams both inside and outside of the setting of a demonstration to prevent serious bodily injury or death. Tear gas can be used by SWAT teams outside of demonstrations to prevent serious bodily injury or death. During a demonstration, it can be used by officers who've been trained in its use within the past 12 months, whether they're regular SPD officers or SWAT team members, doesn't matter. If it's part of a detailed tactical plan developed in advance, and it would prevent serious bodily injury or death. And pepper spray can be used by any officer at any time to prevent serious bodily injury or death, whether during a demonstration or not, and it can be used for the purposes of crowd control, but only if there's a threat of serious bodily injury or death. So you would think, okay, well, you know, where's the ban here? This is really better than no ban. And it prevents the SPD from using these weapons to protect property, for example. They can't use it to punish protesters for exercising their free speech rights, or to just move people around, as part of a policy to move around large crowds, which is how the SPD's been doing it.
Yeah, goodness knows there's a history of that. So that's an important change.
Yeah, so those are important changes. But this bill is still significantly weakened from the original bill, largely because it allows the SPD to determine serious bodily injury or death, and may be difficult for protesters injured by the use of these weapons to prove otherwise. And it was weakened largely because the Department of Justice and the Seattle Police Department argued that without the ability to use these less lethal weapons, Seattle police would have to use police batons and lethal weapons on demonstrators. And the OPA and the Court Monitor agreed with them. But the City Council, of course, has had to incorporate all those recommendations for this bill to pass muster with the court. So the bill isn't going to go to the full council for approval just yet. Lisa Herbold has placed it on hold because Judge Robart will be holding a status hearing on the consent decree on August 10th. Herbold wants to hear his feedback on the bill before she sends the bill to the full council in case there are more changes that need to be made. So that's the status, and that's what's in the bill. Oh, and I want to point out, too, that there was a great article in the South Seattle Emerald this week on July 13th by Carolyn Bick entitled OIG Partial Certification Memos Raise More Concerns Over OPA Investigations.
Yeah, Carolyn's a great reporter.
She's a great reporter. And that article looks at the Office of Inspector General's criticism of how the Office of Police Accountability, the OPA, has been investigating complaints against Seattle police officers that arose during last summer's protests. In these memos, the OIG is raising serious issues about the way the OPA is dropping and not investigating some complaints and some aspects of the complaints that they are investigating. It's definitely worth a read, and I recommend that you check it out.
Yeah, and full disclosure, I also write for this South Seattle Emerald, so Carolyn is a colleague.
Yeah, and this article also brings up an issue that Judge Robart should be addressing in his August 10th hearing, and we'll see if he does. So,
all right. Also this week, Mayor Durkin releasing her proposal for the Equitable Development Initiative.
The Equitable Communities, yeah. The City Council, initially, she budgeted $100 million in the 2021 budget for her own Equitable Communities Initiative funding, and the City Council cut that down to $30 million. About a month ago, the mayor's handpicked committee released its recommendations on how to spend that $30 million set aside in the city budget. They recommended spending it equally on four priorities. One, supporting small minority businesses. Two, equity in education, 3 on housing land acquisition and generational wealth building, and 4 on health services for BIPOC communities. This week, Mayor Jenny Durkan released her proposal to the City Council of what programs she wanted the money to fund and sent a draft ordinance for them to release the hold on the $30 million. Her spending plan on its surface seems to agree with those 4 categories, but when you dig into the details, it spreads the funding out among 18 programs and labels them in a way that superficially looks like she's following those 4 categories, but I don't think they really do. For one thing, there are 7 different city departments that would disperse the funds and manage the programs, but the Office of Economic Development, which typically oversees programs for businesses, will oversee 4 of those 18 programs, totaling $9.7 million, which is not 25% or 1/4 of the $30 million, it's 32.3% or almost 1/3. In addition, there are programs for career training, apprenticeships, and hiring oversight that should fall under the business category, but are spread out into the health and housing categories. That's an additional $3.45 million, which takes the quote-unquote business total up to 44% of the total $30 million budget. And the single largest program is for equitable small and micro business capital loans at $5 million. But there's an additional program called Small Business Technical Assistance, which is $2.5 million. Together, that's $7.5 million right there for small businesses. And the second highest single program is $4.62 million to support a home ownership program. In fact, there are 3 separate programs focused on home ownership, which together total $5.75 million. Now, her handpicked committee had recommended purchasing land for community use and affordable housing developments by BIPOC communities, but there's nothing related to that among these 18 programs, just those 3 programs on individual home ownership only. So these programs really are more a function of Jenny Durkan's upper middle class prejudices, right? Starting a business and owning a single family house. There are some smaller programs for education, food programs, healthcare, et cetera, but they're little stuff in comparison to her main focus, which is living a 20th century private property owning capitalist lifestyle that's really starting to vanish in Seattle. Okay. Now, in addition, the grant process that she's proposing would prioritize smaller BIPOC-led organizations, not larger ones. This could have the effect of locking out existing popular grassroots BIPOC organizations in favor of smaller handpicked startup groups that sync better with Jenny Durkan's priorities. I just want to point that out. Yeah. So we'll see what the city council makes of this. Her spending plan is going to the Finance and Housing Committee, where it will get a hearing this coming Tuesday, July 20th. That committee is chaired by Teresa Mosqueda. The co-chair is Lisa Herbold, and the other 3 members are Lorena Gonzalez, Andrew Lewis, and Dan Strauss. And we will see what they make of this proposal.
And I want to point out that the council has had, unfortunately, 4 years of experience now with Durkan and her games with budget priorities and allocation of money. She spends money the way she wants to, and council has not been very effective in trying to rein her in so far. We'll see what it does this time.
Well, they haven't been afraid to take the red pencil to her budget proposals. So we'll see what they make of this and what changes they make.
Yeah. Right. The problem is whether Durkan will turn around and spend the money the way she wants anyway.
Yeah, whether Durkan will actually follow those changes or not is the question.
Yeah.
Maybe the changes are coming via text and they're just getting deleted. All right, let's move on. Only a few minutes left. Job critical updates on the COVID situation.
Yeah, Washington State reached 70% of people who have had at least one vaccination shot this week. That's a good sign. It's still not enough for herd immunity. And we're seeing an uptick in cases due to the Delta variant, primarily among unvaccinated people. I was in the emergency room last night, and the hospital was full, and the emergency room was crowded. And my concern is that we're going to see that reflected in statistics in this next week. If you are Not vaccinated, by all means wear a mask. For God's sakes, wear a mask and get vaccinated. If you are vaccinated, I think it is still essential to wear a mask in indoor settings because you don't know who is unvaccinated. We saw Los Angeles County this week become the first major jurisdiction in the country to reimpose a mask mandate, whether you are vaccinated or not. And I think that's probably going to be wind up being the default later this summer as the Delta variant becomes more dominant. We're seeing hospitals overwhelmed in parts of the country like Arkansas and Missouri where there are relatively low vaccination rates, and that's the population that's getting sick. It's very, very frightening. We're really seeing two Americas, the America that is vaccinated and the America that is not. And we saw a Harris poll this week that showed that among unvaccinated people, the danger of the Delta variant is actually making them more resistant to vaccine because they're listening to people like Tucker Carlson and the right-wing disinformation machine, and the scare information that is cranking out on vaccines. That is absolutely not correct. They're lying.
Who at this point really should be charged with murder, because that's what these guys are, is they're murderers.
And they are directly responsible for the deaths of people right now. Mm-hmm. Right now. So I'm with Maria on that one. They should be charged.
All right. 2 minutes and talk about the flooding in Germany, which shouldn't be coming as a surprise, but is.
Yeah, this was this week's news in climate change, and there is an extreme weather event somewhere in the world every week, it seems like. This week it was Western Europe, places like Germany and Belgium that had surprise flash floods after torrential rains, and you literally saw towns, the videos showed water 6 feet deep running through downtown streets and, it basically turned them into rivers.
Yeah, talk about frightening.
It was very, very, very frightening stuff. If you see the videos, you'll know what I mean. This is entirely unusual for that part of the world. Certainly in the middle of Northern Hemisphere summer, it is highly unusual, but, it's happening. So yeah, climate change. Deal with it now.
Yeah, what the heck are people waiting for?
Yep.
All right.
Maria, did you want to talk for a minute about Haiti?
Oh, okay. I'll see if I can sum it up in a minute. The assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Four top Haitian security officials were placed under travel restrictions this week and can't leave Haiti. Five Haitian Americans have been arrested, including a Haitian American pastor who apparently appears to be the ringleader, a man named Christian Emmanuel Sanon. A group of Haitian American businesses have been involved for months in organizing, or years in organizing, a coup, and the goal was to get Moïse to resign, not to kill him. One of those companies was a Worldwide Investment Development Group, which was established in August of 2018, just 3 years ago. And I want to point out that it's not clear, but there are signs and growing signs that U.S. government, or at least one U.S. government official in the Trump administration, may have been involved. And this whole fiasco has the hallmarks of a messed up Trump administration plot. Now, it really it really shows you why you don't want to elect someone with zero political experience as the president of the United States, when they speak, especially when they have a penchant for hiring people with no experience at all to do jobs that completely overwhelm them. So I also want to point out
a penchant for hiring thugs too.
Yes, and I also want to point out that this is probably the first coup attempt where we can actually go to the Washington Post and see lists of loan documents and expenses that were paid to stage the coup. It's just incredible, and it has all the hallmarks of a Trump administration fiasco. It is very possible that someone within the Trump administration maybe thought it was a good idea to try to overthrow the president of Haiti. And when Trump didn't get reelected, everything went sideways.
All right. So, well, with that, we are out of time. but we'll be doing this again same time next week.
Yes, we will.